Hey guys, I'm Tawny, founder of Sobriety Tea Party and Readings on Recovery.
And I'm Lisa, author of Girl Walks Out of a Bar. And welcome to our podcast,
Recovery Rocks.
We're going to talk to you about everything from recovery to rock and roll to living in New York City.
We're going to talk about how we got sober, why we got sober, and how we stay sober.
Hey, I'm Tawny.
Hi, I'm Lisa.
And this is Recovery Rocks.
Welcome to our live event.
Welcome.
Welcome.
This is the first time we're doing a live podcast recording, and we're super excited. And to celebrate that, we have a super groovy guest. Lisa, shall we introduce?
Yes. We are so grateful and fortunate to have our dear friend and the author of Material Girl, Mystical World, and now most recently, Sober Curious, our queen, Ruby Warrington. Welcome, Ruby.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. This is a real honor, honestly, like to do your first live one.
No, we're thrilled. We're thrilled. And I think we wanted to start out asking you if you could tell everybody here in the audience, we are in New York City at Hub 17 on 17th Street and 5th Avenue. Letting everybody know a little bit about the book, about how it came to be. What is Sober Curious? What is the book about? And how the book came about. And then we'll take it from there.
So a little bit of the backstory then.
Yes.
How did we get here?
What is Sober Curious?
We're very curious.
Okay.
Sober
curiosity. So I'm glad to hear that. I think we all need to be curious. I think curiosity is one of the best things to cultivate in ourselves, actually, when we're really looking to live a life that's in alignment for us, right? So Sober Curious is a term that I believe I coined. I don't really know. It's kind of everywhere now, but who knows? I started using it to describe.
We'll give it to you. We're going to credit you.
Can I take it?
Yes.
Please have it.
All
okay.
Yours.
Great, thanks. So I started using this about 4 or 5 years ago to describe my own evolving relationship to alcohol, meaning I was questioning my relationship. I was questioning how I was drinking, how drinking was really making me feel, whether or not I had a quote-unquote problem if I was asking all of these questions, mm-hmm. right? Questioning how come it was so normal to drink in our society, how come it was so interwoven into all of our social situations, all of our relationships, all of our family situations, like why is it so everywhere? So this questioning had actually started for me several years before, but it was only about 4 or 5 years ago that I started being vocal about it. And the term sober curious really means exactly that. It means to question, to bring a questioning, curious mind to every impulse or instinct, every invitation, and every expectation to drink, rather than just kind of going along with the dominant drinking culture, what I call the dominant drinking culture, meaning that in the society that we live in, it is the norm to drink. Mm-hmm. In fact, the only people who do not drink are people who cannot drink, because they have identified that they have a problem with drinking, and so they're in a 12-step or a recovery program, or maybe it's for religious reasons, or maybe it's for health reasons. But otherwise, you don't tick one of those three boxes, you're a drinker. Society expects that you're a drinker, that's the norm. And so I kind of got to a point where I was like, hold on, that doesn't seem fair or right, actually. How come we don't really get to question this? Or it's not evident that we're able to question this. Like, why is this not an option for us? And so, that's where the term sober curious kind of came from.
And was it because you weren't liking your relationship with alcohol at that point?
So the questioning for me first began, it was probably about 2010. And at the time, I was going through an extremely stressful period of my life. I was in my dream job, and I was really kind of like flying high in my career. I'd achieved a ton of my ambitions in journalism working in the UK. But I was deeply unhappy, and I was feeling extreme anxiety a lot of the time. My only kind of outlet to find relaxation, pleasure, and enjoyment was when I was drinking. But what I noticed was that after a big weekend of drinking, the anxiety and the bad feelings would come back like 10 times worse. And I began to draw more and more of a kind of like, well, the obvious conclusion, duh, that actually alcohol was really negatively impacting me while I was going through this tricky period in my life. So that's when the questioning first started. And like I said, in the beginning, it was very, very internal. It wasn't something I felt comfortable with talking about out loud necessarily, partly because I thought the common wisdom being, hey, if you are questioning your drinking, that means you're an alcoholic, right, and you must go to AA, right, and that means you can never drink again for the rest of your life.
Taking the online quizzes, like, am I an alcoholic? Am I an addict? And it's like, if you're taking those quizzes, there's probably a problem.
There's probably something wrong.
When I would take those quizzes, I would lie. And I would be like, yes, of course. So clearly I'm not an alcoholic because I told this quiz I do not drink in the morning.
Yeah. And it's like, so at the end, who cares?
Right. Like, who is winning when I lie?
If you're in that headspace, and like Ruby's saying, she's curious about her relationship to alcohol. Like, I think that's so beautiful that you're taking a stand for that you can actually just be like, wait, why am I drinking? Mm. Why do I, do I even want this drink? Mm-hmm. Because I was not introduced to alcohol in that way. I was just like, here, drink this and you'll get shit-faced. And I was like, oh, okay. And so that's how I always drank.
Right.
And then now we're in this new wave of like, oh, there's other ways to live. There's other ways to let loose. And I think that's what I got out of your book and from your events. Ruby hosts these really great events called Club Soda. Can you tell us what soda is?
Yeah. So Club Soda NYC, the soda stands for sober or debating abstinence. Because this is the thing people say to me now that I don't drink, so are you sober? Wait. And I'm like, no, I'm not sober and I don't drink.
Right.
It's kind of like, huh? I'm trying to create new languaging and more expansive conversations around what it means to be sober. Because for me, if someone says to me, are you sober? The implication if I say yes to that is I'm in 12-step, I'm in recovery, I'm sober, abstinent from alcohol. Mm-hmm. And that's not how I identify.
And a lot of people would assume that you label yourself an alcoholic,
which
is also a totally different...
So sober curious is really just about kind of expanding the parameters around what it means to live an alcohol-free life, to include many different experiences, many different paths to getting to that point. Whether or not I'm an alcoholic, it's not a question I ponder anymore, and it's not something that concerns me, because I've got to the point now where I'm like, I don't see any, alcohol has no role in my life. Largely because having over the past 8-9 years brought this questioning mindset to any and all drinking situations, whether it's a drinking situation or a non-drinking situation, any and all interactions with alcohol, I've got to a point where I know that for myself, there's no situation where I need or desire to have alcohol now. So it's just kind of a non-thing. It's just a non-thing for me.
Such a relief now, right?
Such a relief.
It's cheaper. Life's a little bit cheaper. Yeah.
In New York, I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm a kind of a, you know, I like a matcha. A matcha probably costs more than a beer in New York.
Matcha is a lot.
Yeah.
It's like $6 or $7.
It's
so
a lot.
But what does it mean, and what did it mean maybe particularly at first? Because you were always somebody who had a very active social life and, you know, a lot of friends and being out and about with, you know, drinking, as we've discussed, is typically the norm.
Oh, yes.
And how did that, I guess I have two questions about that. One is, how did you feel about going into those situations? And also sort of what was the reaction? You know, how was that received?
Well, so I'll start off by saying that in my previous career as a magazine journalist in the UK, this is a very kind of boozy industry, mm-hmm. as many industries are. But, you know, journalism is up there along with arts and entertainment as one of the high-risk careers for alcohol, substance abuse disorders. And so, there was like my social life, but also my work social life was just awash with alcohol. Like every night there were multiple product launches where there was free booze. So I actually didn't spend a lot of money drinking.
Oh, okay.
Like a lot of the drinking I did was on like, you know, paid for by brands and people launching products and whatever. And I think that's really how I developed this very kind of habitual drinking patterns. It was just so normalized. Interestingly, the questioning of my drinking really began a year or two before I moved here to New York in 2012. And it was actually that move that facilitated a really kind of natural break point and actually catapulted my sober curiosity into a much higher gear. I think anybody who's had the experience of moving to a different city or even a different country, there is this kind of clean slate energy in a way.
Yeah.
And when I came here, I was freelance for the first time, and I was also setting up my online spirituality platform that's all about modern spirituality. And so I was kind of throwing myself into researching things like meditation and yoga and sound baths and breathwork healing sessions. And suddenly I found myself socializing at all these events where alcohol was not on the table, and meeting a whole load of different people who were actually finding or using having different practices and ways to feel joy and connection and bliss and transcendence, which were so many of the things I had been looking for, misguidedly, I now understand, in alcohol. But ultimately, the urge to drink came from a desire to experience these things. And then I moved to New York, started investigating this whole kind of modern spirituality scene, rethrew myself into it, and I was having all these different ways to, yeah, experience all those things that didn't come with a horrible hangover. So then, of course, anytime I did drink, it was just like, whoa, this no longer feels like a fair exchange. What, I want to have an evening of relaxation and connecting to people. The price is feeling shitty for the rest of the weekend. No, that no longer seems to make, no longer makes sense. That's like a really bad deal. How did I buy into that? Like, what? So yeah, I guess in a way, coming here and immersing myself in a whole new social situation, I didn't have necessarily that same jarring thing that so many people have when they are the only one in their social circle mm-hmm. who suddenly is not drinking. And it's like, right. How do I explain this to my friends? Like,
yeah,
when I would go back to the UK, there were the questions. But I think as well, it just kind of, people were, at first I was quite nervous. I was a bit like, oh my God, they're all going to think I moved to New York and turned into like Gwyneth Paltrow or something. Shit. But yeah, I don't know. People were generally quite accepting of it. And I think that's largely because I was coming at it from a place of like, yeah, this feels really great. I wasn't hiding anything from anyone and I wasn't trying to make any excuses for why I wasn't drinking. I was just like very open about it from the beginning.
Yeah. I know for me, a huge part of my drinking was not just sort of getting caught up in the moment and the socializing and all of that, which it certainly was. But a big part for me, especially when I would drink alone, was just to shut off, right? Mm-hmm. Like I would come home at night and feel like, you know, I need to go to sleep. I can't go to sleep. My mind is spinning. I don't feel like I'm enough. I'm nervous about tomorrow. I'm unhappy. And like what I would do is drink to shut that down. Mm. And I know that, you know, from prior conversations that we've had, that there are a lot of other replacements that you have found on this journey that take the place of that shutting down and instead sort of connect you and open up. I was wondering if you might talk about some of like the disco thing that I'm somewhat fascinated with and the things that you do, because I think for some of the people who drink, you know, escape and shutting down what's going on in our head is the objective. So how do we address those, like sort of get past stress and all that without alcohol?
Well, I mean, I think the number one thing is meditation, which I always see people a bit like, I can't believe I'm like saying this, because like we hear this from every angle now, right? It's like, you have to meditate. It's going to do this. And like, I think the other thing, there's a great book that I quote in Sober Curious called The Biology of Desire by a guy called Mark Lewis, who is a former opioids addict turned brain scientist. And he talks in that book about the desire function in our brain and how essentially our brain wants us to seek out and repeat experiences that either bring us pleasure or numb our pain, or in your case, that pain being that overthinking monkey anxious mind, like to shut that down. But your brain's going to find the fastest, most readily available way to do that if that's causing you distress. And he talks about something called now appeal, which is basically we also want to find the fastest, easiest way to bring us pleasure or numb our pain. And because of the way that alcohol is marketed and the way that it's so prevalent in society, it's like, well, of course I'm going to use alcohol. It's just right there, and it's relatively inexpensive, and like, why would I not?
If we're and in it's that fun situation. And it's social. It's glamorous.
Exactly.
Right.
Meditation, on the other hand, I think one of the reasons it's so hard and why I'm always like, oh God, I can't believe I'm telling you meditation, because like honestly, I didn't really start to feel the benefits of having a regular meditation practice for about 2 years after a regular, like daily meditation practice. That's not exactly talking to my now appeal situation. Do you know what I mean?
It's 2 years from now, you're going to feel great.
2 years from now, you're going to feel great, and it's going to feel really difficult to get there, and you're not even going to know if it's working or not for like a long time.
But just don't drink
for
those 2 years.
But just keep going, and just don't drink for those 2 years.
We drank and drugged because we wanted to feel better now.
Right.
So like to tell that to an addict or an alcoholic or just anyone who's struggling,
exactly.
Like why, like how do you convince someone to like actually give this a shot? It's worth your investment.
So there are different forms of meditation as well, right? And you mentioned Kundalini Disco.
Yes.
So Kundalini Disco.
I love this. I haven't done it, but I love it.
So have you heard
to.
Of Kundalini Yoga? I don't know if people yes. are listening and they haven't heard of Kundalini Yoga. It's a style of yoga that mainly uses breath work and mantra, meaning different breathing techniques and mantra that you vocalize as a way to very quickly move stuck energy around your body. And they call the different techniques meditations because you might be doing a certain kind of breathing for anything from like 3 minutes to 30 minutes, right? This has an instant effect. I describe the effect of this practice in the book as kind of like a double espresso with a Prozac chaser. So it's kind of energizing and relaxing at the same time. So that's a kind of meditation where you really can feel the instant effect. And the Kundalini Disco, there's a DJ friend of mine in New York, and she combines this style of yoga with my favorite kind of house music. And when I discovered this, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, not only am I finding a way to really relax and kind of what almost feels like detoxify my system really quickly of kind of a buildup of anxiety and negative emotions, and I get to dance and like get high off the vibes as well.
I remember when I went to your Kundalini Disco, and what was Rama Institute?
Oh,
is that
yes,
where it was?
That was the one, yeah.
We did this thing where I don't know how to describe this for people that aren't here. What am I doing?
she's like swimming.
She's yeah, like swimming circling her arm.
Like doing that, like my shoulder is clicking.
Yeah.
And we did that for, I think, 2 minutes straight.
Probably longer.
Yeah. And then as soon as I was done, the clicking stopped and it released all this tension down my back that I didn't even know I had.
Oh, amazing.
And it was like, and that was the type of instant gratification that like, okay, I was like, okay, I can do this.
Yeah. Kundalini is actually, it has a lot of fans in the recovery community. Are you familiar with Recovery 2.0? Tommy Rosen. So his wife Kia Miller teaches Kundalini Yoga, and I know that they really preach this as a very useful mm-hmm. tool for anyone who's in recovery yeah. because it does give that instant kind of relief effect, and it doesn't take long. You can do a 3-minute breathing thing and feel some kind of shift.
The only time, and I know I've said this before, but the one thing that made me feel in recovery, like kind of getting a high that actually made me go, ooh, I feel kind of high, was after doing 90 minutes of Bikram. Like at the feeling after doing that and sweating all of that out and just being like, for whatever reason, I remember after the first time I did Bikram, and you know, I know there are other ways to do hot yoga now, given that Bikram is not necessarily the preferred choice. We're not, after that, I remember thinking like, oh, I got to do, like, when do I do this again?
Yes.
When do I get this feeling in my head again? And that was like, just like, I'm like, I could get addicted to that.
Was that triggering?
That was okay.
For you?
It was somewhat triggering for me, but then I was like, you know what? I can have this one though. I don't have to. And I remember just thinking that it was just so, I never expected that there could be something where I got that kind of feeling in my head that was just like that. And I, you know, saying it felt like being high is not really right, but it felt just like this
like euphoric.
Like euphoric.
Released,
like
relaxed.
Yeah. Like really
peaceful euphoria.
Yes.
Right, yeah. right.
It's almost like depleted but in a good way where it's like I just left all my shit on that yoga mat and now I'm ready to go back out into Manhattan and just live my life.
It's interesting you mention it. I think it was actually when I discovered Bikram and yoga that coincided with the same time that this questioning began.
Oh,
maybe interesting. It was because somewhere in my psyche I was like, oh, I'm getting that same sense of relief from my from my anxiety and my stress, and I'm getting it there, and now I'm skipping home afterwards and I feel great and I don't have any desire to kind of like drink now. Like, why would
right.
I?
Right.
And in fact, the first time I ever took a month off drinking was, I think, the 2nd January I lived in New York, and I signed up to do the Bikram Yoga 30-Day Challenge.
Oh, yeah.
Because they want you to get addicted
That's so
to
intense.
It. They know how addictive it is. So they're like, do our 30-Day Challenge. It's the best way to get the benefits and get completely addicted.
Right. I remember
but anyway,
always looking
I did
at
the
that.
30 days because I was like, that'll motivate me. Like, thought of going into the Bikram 104-degree heated hot room with a hangover.
Oh.
I was like, no, that's going to be enough motivation to like stick it for a month and see how I go. And actually, I did go in there hungover once during that month, but that was not good.
Yeah. I bet it all got out of you, though.
Well, that was the thing. I think I remember putting on on Instagram afterwards or something like, ultimate challenge, ultimate cure for a hangover.
I have a total non sequitur. I wanted to talk about something in the book that I loved. You talk about Marie Kondo, who I, like many people, are obsessed with.
Want to describe Marie Kondo briefly for people who don't know?
Yeah, I mean, just tidying up. She has an amazing show on Netflix. She wrote several books about tidying up, sparking joy, gratitude, appreciating what you already have. And her approach was about cleaning out your house and things. And what I love about it, and one of the many things I love about this book, is you talk about how you do that, but more on a spiritual level. And that really resonated with me, because in early sobriety, and still now sometimes, I'll find myself, like with the Marie Kondo method, if like someone invites me to an event, and the thought of going brings me anxiety, and I'm like, the thought of going does not spark joy. No. And that was a full sentence. I'm not going. Thank you, but I'm not going. And even like cleaning up Instagram, I was like, wait, why am I even following these people? They're people I used to drink with, and they're taking shots, posting pictures of them getting wasted at bars. Like, I don't even have anything in common. So there's just been this tidying up, Marie Kondoing of my life that has been super powerful right now. So I was wondering if you could touch on that for yourself.
Totally. Well, I mean, if you're thinking, if we were going back to like, what's the fix for those feelings of anxiety and those fear, that worrying mind and the kind of constant fear about what I might have said and what might happen in the future, will condo your inner world. So you get to a point where those like stresses are no longer have that hold on you, you know, and it might be, cutting off certain friendships. It might be like, this job stresses me out way too much. I can't do this. I'm going to have to find another firm. Like, there could be some really big, scary, challenging changes to make, but ultimately those are the changes that are going to lead to the kind of inner peace that means we no longer desire or quote unquote need the drink, you know. But there's another thing I talk about in terms of Kondo. She says, when we're looking to hold on to something, and she's talking about this as material possessions, when we find having a hard time letting go, but I think we can apply this to alcohol too, she's like, it comes from either two things, an attachment to the past or a fear of the future. And so even when we're drinking, it's like, I'm remembering the good times. I can't let those good times go, those friendships, those sunny afternoons in pub gardens. I don't want to let that go, because where will the joy be? Or it's fear of the future. I don't know what's coming around the corner. I'm going to trip out on that. I'm just kind of like, I better just stay here in this kind of like numbed out moment. So I think you can apply that same kind of mentality and actually really focus on, well, what today here in this present moment can help bring, can spark joy. What can I find joyful? Which comes back to the gratitude piece, right?
For what you already have, the friends you have, with sobriety, cutting out drugs and alcohol from my life made me hyper present to what I have. My relationships with my family got so much stronger. The friendships that I held on to are so much stronger now. And the friendships that I didn't necessarily cut off, they just kind of organically fizzled, because we just didn't really have anything in common anymore.
Yeah. An organic fizzle is going to happen. That's totally fine.
Like, it sounds like a drink, like an
organic,
like
organic
a
organic
seltzer.
That's a mocktail.
It's a good mocktail.
Yeah, no one take that. Okay.
It's yours.
Thanks,
but it's true. And one of those things that I'm super grateful for, I remember in the first months, years, whatever, of not having alcohol in my life, just really feeling so grateful every morning I woke up not hungover, of like the physical feeling, of the physical feeling of not having toxins in my body, and just being really appreciative of the fact that I have a completely calm gut now. I used to have kind of gross, but like bad IBS stuff that would just kind of linger, and that never happens anymore. And I'm always finding just moments of the day where I'm like, I feel physically like great, and thank you. And I know
thank
this is
you.
A, and
yeah,
thank
that's
you.
My
and I
thing.
Know this is a result of not drinking. Yeah. Like, it's that simple.
Yes. Yes.
Even the stuff that comes with the hangover, like physical, yes, but I had just become so accustomed to looking through my phone and being like, I can't believe I texted him. I can't believe I
told
her. Oh
my God,
that.
Not waking up with that
and
fear
at, like,
and regret.
Looking at my bank account of like, I spent $50 at this one bar. Like, that, I don't, not having that anymore. I was like, that's just part of life.
Right.
And I accepted that for so long.
You accepted that bad deal
that
you were assigned.
And now I know I deserve
told
more.
You, Tawny, you need this drink. You need this.
I know. I believed it.
Yeah, we all believe it, because we're not given an alternative. Mm-hmm. The only alternative we got given is like, oh, you're the non-drinker. Oh, well, you get water to drink. And you also like have to, you get these kind of places to socialize where it's going to smell bad and the music's going to be too loud and like, you know, it's like, no, but that is changing rapidly.
It is changing. Yeah. We're very grateful to live in New York City where there's so many sober events, even if they're not quote, sober, like there's just a lot going on that's not alcohol based.
Yes,
you can go to a gallery opening, you can go to a Broadway show, you can just like, these events are not focused around alcohol. Where like I grew up in a small town where that there really wasn't a whole lot to do. I definitely take responsibility for my actions, but there wasn't a, wasn't.
Yeah.
Before, I know we're getting close on time, but before, one of the things that I really wanted to hit on and ask you about is, you know, when we talk very inclusively on this podcast about all kinds of recovery, we've obviously, Tawny and I have both done things very differently. I have been 12-step since day one, and Tawny does not. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how the whole idea of sober curious, which does not involve saying I'm completely abstinent, which does not involve saying I'm powerless over alcohol or saying I'm an alcoholic or going to meetings, like how has that, how has the book been received and how has that conversation been in that sort of, because I know that in 12-step can there can be judgment.
Yeah.
I choose to not participate in that, but I know that there certainly can be that, as in it's the only, quote, right way.
Yeah, the only way,
right.
Actually. The only safe way as well.
So if you...
Yeah, I'm really glad you touched on this. I'm wearing, for listeners, for anyone who can't see, I'm wearing a t-shirt that says imposter on it.
I love it. I love that.
Because, you know, this show's called Recovery Rocks, and I'm not in recovery. I don't drink alcohol, but I'm not sober, and I'm not saying I'm never going to drink alcohol again. And that's definitely a kind of a tricky thing for many people to wrap their heads around. Because we haven't had that an expansive a conversation about this until very recently. And when the book first came out, the first chapter is called The Nature of the Beast. And it really kind of like lays out what exactly we're dealing with, like this substance, what it is, how we interact with it as humans, how our brains interact with it. And as a way of kind of like opening up the idea, I have this idea that perhaps anybody who drinks alcohol on a regular basis is maybe a little bit addicted, like maybe just a little bit, maybe. Anyway, I go into that in depth in the first chapter, The Nature of the Beast, but I was going to call that chapter A Dangerous Conversation because I was very worried when I first started being vocal about my different path to sobriety or non-drinking that I would, that I wasn't even worried about so much about the kickback I might get. I was worried that I might be endangering people's recovery. Because that's very much the messaging I had received and internalized, and very much what we hear is like, for an addict, somebody who has the chronic disease of alcoholism, abstinence, as described in the 12-step programs, is the only cure. And actually any other kind of conversation around this is very dangerous. It's a slippery, it's keeping the door open to a slippery slope that will lead someone to their their ultimate demise. So I was very, very nervous about that. And in fact, it's really, in the 4 years or more that I've been like openly vocal about this, I think I've probably had about three people ever actually say, you can't be saying this, which was a huge surprise and this was a big relief to me.
Yeah.
And it also, because I just think that, you know, what I'm trying to do, like I said, is create a conversation that is expansive enough for many different voices, for many different people's experiences, whilst completely acknowledging, as I do multiple times in the book, but that for anybody sort of at the, you know, the more severe end of the addiction spectrum, abstinence, 12-step, that's what you need. It's what's going to save you, you know? But that's not necessarily, I think more and more, and you guys must be aware of this too, within the kind of medical profession as well, there's a much more conversation and discourse around the idea that there are shades of gray when it comes to addiction.
Right.
And I think that the either 12-step AA abstinence or normal drinker kind of divide is sort of breaking down. And I think people are realizing more and more that actually this, the 12-step model is not right or necessary for everybody who's identified a problem with drinking. And I think that actually keeping it that black and white prevents many, and I will say millions more people than would ever find their way to a non-drinking life from even starting out on the journey, because it's so, it can be so intimidating to somebody like me who, by the time I took my, I have been to a few AA meetings, and by the time I got there, I was probably drinking maybe a couple of times a month. It wasn't like that. I never woke up and had those mornings where I had like texts and it wasn't causing chaos in my life at all. Mm-hmm. It was just like an annoying habit that I couldn't quite shake, you know? So for me, 12-step wasn't necessary. And had I not started my own conversation around it, perhaps I would have just continued drinking, thinking, oh, well, I'm a normal drinker who maybe just can't handle it sometimes, and that's just part and parcel of drinking, and I'll just continue as I'm doing. And
settling, basically.
And settling, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, before we peace out, how can we find you on Instagram, and where can we buy your book?
Well, the book is here for anybody here.
Copies here. The book is on Amazon.
Okay.
All the formats. There's an audio book too with me reading it, which was fun. And my Instagram, that Instagram handle where I talk about most of this is just at Ruby Warrington. So that's the best place to find me for Sober Curious.
But you also have another Instagram handle that I do think people would be interested in.
Okay, so my other Instagram is the_numinous. And that's the Instagram for my platform that's all about modern spirituality. And actually, I think that at first I was like, you know, do these really cross over? Are my numinous people really interested in sober curiosity? But like I said, for me, finding the tools that I talk about on the numinous, meditation, yoga, breathwork, mindfulness practice, these have been essential parts in healing the parts of myself that thought I needed alcohol in order to function and be a human being in society. Yeah. So it was actually only having found those tools and brought them into my life that I've been able to walk this path so confidently and so cleanly, I think. And I think there was even another study that came out recently. I can't remember where I read this quote, but it was something about saying, actually, the rise in mindfulness practice, the mainstreaming of things like meditation and yoga are actually some of the most useful tools that people can have for their recovery,
yes.
Whether they're in 12-step, whether they're walking a different path. So yeah, that's all on the numinous. Lots of fun and accessible ways to dive in.
Great.
Well, Ruby, thank you so much.
We're honored.
This was a lot of fun. This was so fun.
Yeah. And thanks everybody for coming. Thanks for listening.
To hear from you guys, if anybody wants to ask questions, have any discussion, comments, weigh in, you can find me at Girl Walks Out on Twitter, on Instagram, and my website is lisasmithauthor.com.
Yes, and you can find me at Tawny M. Lara, and my website is tawnylara.com. And my blog you can find at sobrietyparty.com.
That's right.
T-E-A.